Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. Okay, well, we're still waiting for things to warm up here, even slightly in this dreary February. So, here are 3 stories from the recent archives to bring some warmth to your bones.
Then something new came up. My mother discovered France. There was wine, a new concept here.
Flattened blades of grass at the foot of each tree, identifying our beds, with a fallen leaves underlay.
By the 3rd trip to the GP, the numbness is up to my waist. By now, I'm also menopausal. The doctor has no idea what's about to hit him.
Get ready for a summer holiday in France, a bit of rough sleeping in London, and a frightening journey into the world of medicine. 3 wonderful true stories. So, let's get stuck in, and up first is Melanie Bowden. She told this story in July 2022, when the theme was holiday. Take it away, Melanie.
This year, as we balance our wish to wander with the fear of getting forever lost in airport security and baggage halls, I suppose it wasn't so long ago that flying to your holiday destination for a family holiday was a luxury most couldn't afford. Our family, though, were part of the new summer traveller explorers going 2 weeks out of Lisbon for the 12th holidays in a Ford Cortina. Anywhere in Ireland was our usual route. My mother was always the well-read one, finding out about a place she'd like to visit and sharing her enthusiasm with my father. He usually was busy managing pricing and planning electrical jobs because of another bomb or other, so he wasn't always over where he or the rest of us would be going on holidays. But go we did, each year without fail, and it was usually a wonderful respite for both my parents as they, like most of the rest of the population, tried to muddle through what was the troubles at that time. Then something new came up. My mother discovered France. There was wine, a new concept here, and beaches and sun and café au lait. Also a move up from camp coffee essence. We were from Carrickfergus originally, and having moved to the town of Lisburn in the early 1970s, it was a big deal for my mother's family. Granny thought we'd move to the Free State. When my mother and father shared the idea that we were going to France by car and boat, she was full of wonderment, asking, would it not be full of foreigners? Our first adventure may also have been our last, but that's the good thing about not being able to predict the future. Canvas Holidays, an English-based company, were a new concept run by a husband and wife team who had advertised holidays in the Belfast Telegraph. They picked campsites in areas in the north and south of France, and they provided all you'd need for a camping holiday in a pre-prepared tent. They even told us how to contact the AA to get a personalised route finder for your trip. There were even reps on the campsite to help navigate and direct you to the local places of interest. What an adventure that would be, my mother thought. So, after much planning, reading up on the area and booking on my mother's part, Dad stopped work for his holidays, stuck on those yellow stickers on the front car lights for driving on the right, put that white and black GB sticker on the boot, and yes, the tinfoil cover to put across the front windscreen was also packed, as apparently this kept the heat out. Having never been further south than Cork, how were we to know how hot it would be? Dad packed our bags, including all the food for our trip, because life was more costly then, even than now, and the 3 of us got in the back. I was the middle child. Of course I sat in the middle seat. I was 12 years old, my older brother was 15, and our younger brother was 6. Mum, in her quest for fully exploring the northwest of France, had booked us a 2-centre holiday. We had 1 week in the Vendée and 1 in Normandy. We had no idea what to expect, but trusted her. My older brother had 3 years French under his belt at school, and I knew how to ask for the location of the bibliothèque. We drove, Dad behind the wheel, with no cruise control, seat belts or car seats, never mind air conditioning, from Lisburn to the boat at Rosslare. Overnight, we sail to Le Havre in northern France, then on down the west coast until the AA route map, read out line by line by my mother, delivered the five of us to our first campsite. So far, so good. My father had driven us hundreds of miles, and the only casualty thus far was the butter in the cool bag. It had melted. A few days later, my father, when walking about, tripped off a pavement, and that's when my holiday story takes a more negative twist. He always had a bad back, but something much worse had gone wrong, as he suffered terrible pain and was unable to sit or bend. He'd slipped a disc. We went to our trusty Canvas holiday camp reps, who spoke with the doctor on the phone, who decided he didn't need to come and sent a nurse. All of us, being used to the NHS, didn't imagine we had to do anything now except wait for the treatment and maybe show our travel health insurance. It transpired when the health professional came and looked at our documents, the insurance did cover a nurse to administer a pain-relieving injection, but we had to supply the cotton wool and some cleaning agent, or perfume would do. These were hastily dug out from soap bags, and my mother's scent was sprayed on a part of the anatomy not usual for eau de parfum. Whilst my father had some ease for a while, it was not a fix, and the pain returned, leaving him still quite immobile. And of course, this was the halfway point in our holiday when we had to move campsites. The camp we were in was fully booked, so there was nothing else for it, but we had to move on, making the 250-kilometre journey in the Cortina. My father lay in the back seat with his leg out the window. He was 6'3". My older brother was promoted to navigator, and I perched in the cool box in the space between the back seat and the driver's seat. Only Tiny Tim, age 6, had the space he needed in the back. We made it safely to campsite number 2, again thanks to the AA route finder, but the pain and discomfort had not abated, so this time a doctor came to the tent and said Dada needed to go home by ambulance. This was something no one had foreseen, and my parents had not the money to get my father home by ambulance, and speaking French to the level needed to negotiate was well above their patois. And nobody needed to know where the bibliothèque was either. The reps in the campsite were all students, and this was well out of their remit too. My mother therefore went to a payphone with one of the reps and contacted my father's workplace, Grahams of Dromore, for help. They were wonderful, and seeing the predicament of the Hudkinsons on their first trip abroad, they sorted out the travel arrangements, transferred money to my mother through the bank near to the campsite, and enabled my dad to start his journey home. My older brother was promoted from navigator to companion now and was sent ahead in the French ambulance with Dad to travel onto the boat and back home. My father's return home coincided with the remaining week of the 12th holidays alongside an ambulance strike in Ireland. But the Knights of Malta came to the rescue and brought the two of them home ahead of us into the comfort and support of the National Health Service. Meanwhile, my mother had to drive my younger brother and I home. I was promoted to be navigator this time. No Google Maps voice then. But we got to our boat on time, I'm delighted to say, so it shows how good those AA route maps were back in the day. Travelling up Ireland, though, I did point out once or twice to my mum that maybe driving on the left was needed here, as we were no longer in Europe. She was exhausted by then, and I'm sure overwrought with worry and keen to get home as soon as possible. The new motorways had not yet been constructed, so it did take us rather long time to get back from Rosslare. My father ended up in Musgrave Park Hospital for spinal surgery after his assessment and x-rays. No wonder after the journey he'd had. But thankfully he made a full recovery. At the time, I was an avid reader of the Jackie Girls magazine, and they were always looking for stories. So I thought I'd send my story of holiday misfortunes off to them, written by hand and posted, to retell the holiday we just had. I had my story printed in the magazine as a star letter, and I got £5 too. My parents are to be commended as intrepid travellers and were always full of wonder for what was beyond our shores, and our family holidays continued for many more years until they wouldn't pay our fares any longer and we had to go on our own trips. Until their deaths, they continued to search out unusual travel destinations on holidays abroad, but made sure they'd health insurance to cover all eventualities. Holidays can be the making or breaking of us. So next time you go, make sure your insurances are up to date, your smartphone is all the stuff you need for travel, and stay safe.
Thanks so much, Melanie. Good advice indeed. And your poor dad betrayed for a fiver. But hey, what a great story. You need to come back soon with more. If you're wondering what the process is for telling your story at 10x9, it's really simple. Check out the themes and dates on the website events page and submit your story through the submissions page. That's all 10x9.com. I'll give you feedback and help you make it the best it can be. It doesn't matter if it's just a vague idea or a fully formed epic, get in touch. And if you're a bit nervous, shy, or reluctant, I'll do my best to make it as easy a process as possible. Okay, on to our next story, and here's Joe Milliken, who was at the 10x9 mic for the first time. It was November of last year, and the theme was night.
The long, drawn-out, amazing summer of 1976 was easing its way towards autumn. I was on the Larne Stranraer ferry with big brother Robin, a Bob Dylan lookalike, and at times when he cut his curves off, like Leonard Cohen, strangely. And we were enjoying the calmness of the sailing, a very unusual experience when things just seemed to go so smoothly. We were enjoying the beauty of the sea over having a few pints of tartan. Within a few hours, we lifted our thumbs as we hitchhiked down to London, where we would meet up with young Roy, a mutual friend. We made remarkable progress, getting to North London by early evening and meeting Roy in the Archway Tavern, an iconic pub dating back to 1815 and renowned as a meeting place for the Irish over many decades. Upon our arrival, some smart aleck at the jukebox put on "The Boys Are Back in Town" by Thin Lizzy. Roy said our digs were just as we had left them when we had left on Friday night for a quick visit home. We chatted a bit about how to get a shift of labour and work in the morning if we went down to Camden Town. We all knew that Robin stood the best chance, as he had proved in the past in his success in wheeling bricks and mortar to the brickies on site. It was a strange ritual. If you can imagine, in Camden Town, that part of London, down at the tube station, it was like a cattle market. As many gathered, mostly Irish, at the tube station, lined out as the subbies, or men who walked by and winked or nodded at the chosen and suitable candidates. Robin had a ruddy, lean Irishness about him, even though he did look like Bob Dylan. Whereas Roy had an impish Peter Pan look with large blue eyes peering over his Chelsea scarf, as if hiding from the prospect of work. As for me, you could say there was not a lot going for me in the context of the building site world. If I was lined up along with these seasoned navvies, 9.5 stone, gold-rimmed John Lennon glasses, and dirty fair ringlets fawn over a lumberjack jacket, the purple loons didn't help either. So we concluded that at least Robin could try his hand at the crack of dawn at securing cash in hand tomorrow evening, and carrying on the tradition of Irish navvies building English roads and canals, etc. But we must now head to our unconventional digs for the night. Darkness was stepping just ahead of us as the orange glowing streetlights directed our way to Highgate Woods. And you can a picture of the size of the Wiz when it had 7 gates. Perhaps appropriately, we had chosen the Gypsy Gate. It was Roy and I who had discovered this unusual abode in the midst of a city of minions. Without a roof over our heads, this was our fourth week in these free lodgings with no deposit required. Roy had bravely guarded the area in our absence, and tonight we followed the ritual of arriving after the iron gates had been chained and locked. We then deftly scaled them to land on the gritty gravel path on the other side. Moonlight guided us along the path to where it forked at the Green Fountain. We would turn right and at the third tree on the left through the wire fence, and soon we were now at the familiar setting. Flattened blades of grass at the foot of each tree, identifying our beds, with a fallen leaves underlay. We were in good spirits as the late yet bright evening aided us in this exciting enjoyment of nature in this amazing summer. With each tree as a backrest, we joked and laughed about bygone days, sharing cigarettes and passing round the flagon of cider. We bade each other a contented good night and settled down in the still, warm air. I felt lulled to sleep by the distant sound of passing cars. Then, a few hours later, I felt a tug on my right shoulder. It was Roy. "Joe, do you hear something?" "Yes, I can hear you talking to me and Robin snoring, but why would that be an interest?" He says, "No, listen." And then I heard it. A strange, distant sound which started to get clearer and louder. It was like a swishing type of noise of someone or something was trouncing through the long braids of grass. And it certainly seemed to be heading our way. Whatever it was not what we expected at this time of evening. As it came almost upon us, my heart skipped a beat. Suddenly I saw this white shape heading towards me. But just as quickly I was reassured when the white shape called out, "Joe, did you hear that?" It was Robin, crawling quickly over from his tree. He had removed his black coat for a pillow, and his bright white shirt emerging from the dusky background was the source of my alarm. We were now all three huddled together, like real adults, each trying not to show fear of the unknown. The noise was incredibly loud, and we were certain that whatever or whoever it was would now appear. But no, and this was the strangest thing. The noise came to an abrupt halt, and then we really started to get frightened. It or she or he must be looking at us, surveying the scene, ready to pounce. But nothing happened. Stillness. Not a sound, incredibly still, except for my beating heart and Robin's uneasy, asthmatic breathing. Fear was tightening its grip. Not knowing what to do, there was not even a sound of anything slipping away. Not a hint. So all we could do was wait. And I assumed that the others were just like me, lying with eyes firmly shut, wanting to open at least one eye, but not daring. And time just slipped away into the early morning. And as light dawned, I was the first to notice that our squashed tomato white breaded sandwiches had a huge bite out of them. So the speculation began. It must have been Eric or David playing a prank. We last saw them in the Archway Tavern, and such a thing would not be beyond them. Then again, they had more than the usual quarter of pints, and we doubted that they would even get over the gate. But we could not decide, could not be convinced what had visited us that night. I concluded that it must have been a badger who didn't like tomato sandwiches enough to finish them off and was also clever enough to slip away on tiptoes. Still, It proved a good story in later years to tell my young girls at bedtime. They know it as the Badger story. But even now, I wonder. Whatever. Good night and sleep well.
Ah, Joe, thanks so much. Squash tomato sandwiches. Who could resist? I hope you'll be back with us soon with more stories. Just a quick thank you to all who have donated to 10x9 via Patreon and at our live events over the years. It really helps to keep this project going, and we are so grateful. Now, just before we move on to our third story, some sad news. If you listened to the previous podcast, that's Pod 295, there was a wonderful story about a bothy and some whiskey from Paul Whittington. Paul had been coming to 10x9 for a few years, and from his very first story about the family cat, yes, Whittington's cat, he was something special. Sadly, Paul died this week, and on behalf of 10x9, I would like to send our sympathies to his family. He was always a pleasure to deal with and a joy to listen to. Thank you, Paul. Okay, on to our third and final story on this podcast. It was March 2022, and the theme was reality. Here's Lorna Dunn.
It's not every day you wake up in a semi-conscious stupor in prison. I was drifting back to consciousness, the incommodious floorboard stabbing my bruised ribs. Squinting groggily at the climbing bars on the walls, it came to me slowly, painfully slowly. I'd come here on my weekly volunteer visit to Sochten Prison, Edinburgh. After that, nothing. This sort of misadventure was becoming an unwelcome habit. Just weeks before, I'd been at work in Dunfermline Hospital. One minute I was talking to my boss, Kathy. The next I was waking up in one of the wards. I was supposed to be gathering feedback on patient satisfaction, but this was taking things to ridiculous lengths. Why was I lying in bed with Kathy on one side and my mother on the other, like disparate guardian angels? Why did my head feel as if it was clasped in a set of birthing forceps? Kathy explained in her Aberdonian tones that I'd collapsed on the floor of her office without warning. That was the foreshock, the first of the tremors in my world, suggesting the earthquake to come. After a third collapse, accompanied by trembles and seizures, it was decided that tests were required. The proud owner of my first ever car, I drove to the Drieg Drab Western General for a scan. My body was impelled into the narrow interior of the MRI for the first time, with barely an inch between my forehead and the scanner's interior. Feeling intense claustrophobia, I entered the cylindrical coffin. The result? I'd been having bleeds in my brain, and they'd triggered epilepsy. When they informed me of this and the fact that I'd be banned from driving for 2 years, I buried my head in the hospital's cellular blanket and sobbed. 2 interminable years. Fast forward 15 years, and I'm married with an 8-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old son. Many of you have heard the story of how at 6 he had a brain hemorrhage and lost the sight in one eye, necessitating major neurosurgery. When this occurred, I couldn't help but sense there was some kind of connection with my own bleeds. Tests were sent off to genetics, but the result came back saying no link. 10 years later, I'm 46 and a teacher. As I walk around school, I'm aware that my big toe is strangely numb. The sensation stubbornly remains, and after a few months, it spreads to my foot. I visit my GP. He's a nonchalant fellow with scruffy hair, who's laid back about it all, full of self-confidence, and hearty Ulster meals. But by the time I return a month later with the numbness reaching my knee, he does manage to send me off for nerve conduction tests. It's like something from 1984. Electrodes are placed on my body, electric shocks applied at varying levels of intensity. The highest intensity is intense. Is this actually legal, I think, because it reminds me of a highly disturbing psychology experiment I once read about. Following the Orwellian torture, I'm told calmly, there's nothing wrong with you. Have you ever been told that, yet known with complete conviction that there's something very wrong? By the third trip to the GP, the numbness is up to my waist. By now, I'm also menopausal. The doctor has no idea what's about to hit him. This time, he will listen. I march in, stare him straight in those nonchalant eyes and assert, there's something wrong with me and you need to do something about it now. Yes, right. He mumbles, okay. So you might need to see a neurologist. Yes, I do, I growl. It seems, he stutters, glancing at his computer, there's a 2-year waiting list for neurology. 2 years. A mighty menopausal rage mounts within me. By then, both my legs will be numb, my body will be numb, my brain will be numb. Reluctantly, I pay to see an NHS doctor who's free of charge in the daytime and involved in big budget extortion at night. I sit in a plushly upholstered armchair and pour out my story. In moments, an appointment is miraculously booked. It's mentioned in passing that if no action is taken, I will probably become paralysed. Okay, something is wrong. Another MRI looms over me like the Cave Hill on a miserable January night at 5 p.m. in the driving rain. This time, I take matters into my own hands and procure diazepam from the GP. As my husband drives me to Belfast, I take the diazepam with a carefully prepared G&T from the water bottle. In 10 minutes, Belfast looks sublime. Next, a follow-up visit to neurosurgery. I sit gingerly facing the neurosurgeon with his white, spiky hair and arctic blue eyes. He goes straight to the point, indicating the computer screen whereupon are my MRI results is explained that I have cavernomas, blackberry-shaped bulges in my blood vessels, which mean bleeding is more likely because the vessel walls are thinner. They occur in the brain and in the spinal cord. I have no less than 10 in my brain and 1 in my spine. The one in my spine has bled, causing nerve damage and the growing numbness, and I'm going to need surgery to stop the bleeding. It'll involve breaking my neck, and the op may lead to paralysis. Basically, if there's no op, I will become paralysed. If I do take the op, I might become paralysed. That day, the map in my brain of who I am and where my life is heading is completely redrawn. How do you prepare for possible paralysis? How do you absorb such a radically altered concept of your own personal reality? I try to imagine waking up paralysed, but my brain totally vetoes this intolerable image. Of course, it's linked to my son's bleed as a child because I'm now informed cavernoma syndrome is inherited and we carry the gene. Another seismic shift. When I awake from the surgery, my husband speaks to me from the foot of my bed. I can't bend my neck because it's broken. So I stare up at the cracked white tiles and try desperately to move my legs. Nothing. Oh God, I pray, is this it? I can't move my legs, I yell, totally terror-struck. How come you just kicked me in the jaw then? Comes the indignant reply. But he's laughing with profound relief. He explains that later that my legs were thrashing about all over the place. I can't feel a thing though. I've lost the feeling in both legs during the operation and I can't tell what they're doing. In fact, I've lost 90% of all feeling below the waist. Painfully, I learn to walk again and control those spookily disembodied legs. I still can't tell where my feet or legs are, if I can't see them. I've walked out of my shoes on several occasions only to find them waiting for me on the way back after shopping. I've fallen off chairs and bikes because I can't feel my bum. Walking downstairs always requires me to watch my feet fastidiously so I don't miss a step. Oh, and there's been constant back pain for the past 5 years. And yet, I walk or swim daily, and almost every time I do it, I thank God for the ability to move. It's no longer something I take for granted. Life itself is precious. There are still 10 cavernomas in my brain, and I have a constant awareness that both my children have inherited this gene, and that one's already suffered a brain hemorrhage and lost the sight in an eye as a result. These unwieldy realities are my constant and daily companions. But I walk, swim, teach, kayak, write, live a near normal life. I know life could be cut short because of my condition, so I've decided it's too short to continue to edit out all the dissonant, recusant parts of me that just don't blend into Northern Ireland's culture. And I'm learning to try to express myself again. 10x9 is beginning to help me there. After all, only 2 families in Northern Ireland have this gene. I'm a rare breed.
Lorna, thanks so much. What a brilliant yet harrowing story. I look forward to having you back at 10x9 soon. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website, that is 10by9.com. The dates for 2025 are all there, along with a couple of themes to get you thinking. And when you find a theme that fits, send me your story. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. And I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks to everyone who makes 10by9 live events happen, wherever they are. The wonderful Leanne, Margaret, Chris, and Cara. The lovely team at the Black Box, the best venue in Belfast. The audience, of course, they really make the storytellers and me feel right at home. And of course, thanks to all our storytellers everywhere. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Melanie Bowden, Joe Milliken, and Lorna Dunn. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.